I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word Podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word Podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
Our press secretary gave alternative facts to that.
My goal in this deposition was to be truthful, but not particularly helpful.
Welcome to Unspun, the podcast that makes you better at finding the truth. The way people get news is changing. It used to be that there were many reporters who would research stories and write articles, but now politicians and famous people share information directly with you on social media and the internet. That means you find out things fast, but it's up to you to make sure the information's actually accurate. And newsmakers don't always do their part. The temptation to manipulate information is strong. They bend the truth to deceive so that they can avoid accountability, so that they can advance their agendas. When you recognize these agendas, you can sometimes find out what's real. And we're at a crossroads where anyone can share anything online, so it's important to sharpen your critical thinking skills. Finding that deception before it goes viral is pretty much a survival skill now, and we're gonna do it together. Let's get unspun.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's Unspun. Did you know that aspirin used to be a brand name? It's true, and there are a bunch of other things that suffered the same fate, cellophane for one and escalators for another. There were company trademarks that lost that protection because their use became so common that the government declared them common names. There's other brands that are fighting hard against that today. Jell-O wants you to call their wiggly concept a gelatin dessert. Xerox wants you to photocopy. I got hate mail back when I was reporting because I had referred to people sipping soda from a styrofoam cup. It turns out that styrofoam is a kind of housing insulation and not something you would make a cup out of. That's expanded polystyrene foam, and try saying that three times fast. The chemical company that made styrofoam actually paid someone to look for references to their products in the media so that they could send modestly threatening desist letters. It matters to the company because when the word becomes commonly identified with the type of product, you can actually lose your right to have it as a trademark. One word I think a lot of us use that way is Google. You know, to look up stuff on the web. And there are actually different search engines. Bing if you love Microsoft or live in China. DuckDuckGo if you're a privacy enthusiast. But all of these search engines do the same thing. They try to take the vast amount of online information and bring it down to specific answers to questions that you ask. Google dominates the English-speaking market by a good bit. And no wonder. It's lean, it's fast, and it often gets you what you want. But does that mean it does a good job? It turns out that the answer to that is pretty complicated, and it kind of depends on how you define good. So let's look at this in a little more depth this week. Researchers have found that a lot of people think search engines display results neutrally and without bias, mostly because they seem to be automated. They're not really right, though. Like any other media company, search engines are a business. As a part of their business model, these search engines actively control what users see, which can lead to skewed search results, a phenomenon known as search engine bias. And the bias in search results has several different sources, according to studies by Novin and Myers. You know, you might have heard the term garbage in, garbage out when it comes to things that computers process. And boy, is that true for search. A search engine can only return information that's already contained in the servers it can access. And although there is a lot that is there, it's far from everything. So, you know, for example, we have a whole type of research that we call archival research that involves people going back to old sources and rediscovering what's in them for new audiences. Just as an example, Harvard professor Annette Gordon-Reed won the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize for archival work for her book Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings in American Controversy. Her book focused not only on their relationship, but also on the efforts and pratfalls of historians who had studied that relationship before. There's been an effort for a long time to digitize the information that's held in those kind of archives. But when you stop to think that it's a lot of human history that's kept in those early records, there's a lot that's just not there. The Library of Congress in the U.S., for example, has volunteer opportunities to look at the text of old letters and handwritten documents and transcribe them. I could put a link to some of those efforts in the show notes if you'd like to learn more about that. But until that kind of work happens, that information, those answers, it's not really searchable. And a lot of times, when we're looking for answers to problems that we face today, people who came before us have already solved those kind of problems. So that's the first search engine bias. It only has access to digital information. This is made worse by the fact that places that have more money have been better able to put information online. That doesn't mean that great information doesn't exist in other places. It just means that we don't always have access to it. One example I think of is how the oldest versions of Hebrew scripture and the Dead Sea Scrolls, that was not found until 1947, and it was just because a stray goat led its shepherd into a cave that was thousands and thousands of years old. So that information, it was there, but it just wasn't accessible to modern eyes. A second really important group of biases are the ones that you already carry with you. Now don't feel bad, everybody has biases. But whenever you get a search result page and you click on it, you are teaching the search engine what kind of information you want. That can be really effective. If I type in season and I want information on oregano rather than wintertime, I'm going to be less frustrated if the search results I get are spice-oriented. But your biases can be a lot more than that. So maybe you believe the New York Times is fake news and you trust the Daily Wire. Maybe you think Real America's Voice is propaganda, but you think CNN is fine and dandy. It really doesn't matter. The search engine is there to give you what it thinks you want, a feature that they call matching searcher intent. In doing what you want, it does introduce some biases in the results. Now, if you're trying to give back good search information, why would you introduce those biases? It goes back to search engines being businesses, right? As businesses, their biggest goal is to make money. If you're a search engine, you want people coming back to you every time they have a question so that you can show them sponsored content and you can make money from advertisers. The searchers are only going to come back if they're getting the information they want and expect. So, it's in the best interest of the search engine to give you what you want. That may not be the best information, it may not be unbiased information, it may not even be what you need, but it is what keeps you coming back. The third type of bias that Noven Myers identified is algorithmic bias. Algorithms is a word we toss around a lot, and it really just means a set of rules for making a decision. Usually, humans create the algorithms that machines then use to do different kinds of actions. And search engines depend on their algorithms. They're very, very important. They create the answer that the search engine gives, and to the extent that the results are good, good algorithms keep people coming back, so the search engine makes money. They're basically like a big trade secret. They're so important that there's an entire industry called search engine optimization, or SEO, that involves people who try to understand how it is that search engine algorithms work so that they can get their client websites to be the ones that get returned first in search. Because those algorithms are created by people, those algorithms do have biases. There are biases in the way results are ranked and in the way that they're displayed. And some of those biases can really matter. So, for example, Kazuyuchi and his colleagues noted that when they looked for controversial topics like abortion and gay marriage, although search engines maybe didn't only show one side of an argument, they did color the results with a particular ideology. So, for example, they could favor conservative or to favor liberal views. When it comes to elections, these kinds of biases can have an impact. Epstein and Robertson did some experiments where they found that returning search rankings that were biased could have as much of a 20% effect on the voting preferences of undecided voters. This is something they call the search engine manipulation effect. This suggests that the way that those algorithms work can actually have the power to change election outcomes, and the users don't really know anything about it. That bias isn't just with text. Other researchers looked at Google search by image algorithms and found that it tends to simplify or stereotype, and that it will discriminate against females and against non-white individuals. An example I think of is, I'm a college professor. If you go do a Google image search and you ask it to search for college professor, you're going to find a lot of results that don't look very much like me. Now, I will say, I've done that search several times over the years, and interestingly, when I did it right before I put this episode together, the results had improved a lot. They did have some people of color, and they also had both men and women as college professors. When I searched for this about 5 years ago, pretty much everything that was returned was a white guy with a beard in a tweed jacket with elbow patches. I will say there are still some biases. For example, most pictures of college professors show college professors lecturing, and there are many college professors who don't lecture at all. For example, if you teach studio art at a college, you're not usually standing in front of a big lecture hall full of students. Same if you teach in a chemistry lab. That aside, though, it does show an important point. Search engine algorithms change. I actually teach a class in search engine optimization for graduate students. One of the things that's exciting but also frustrating about teaching that class is how often those algorithms change. Just this semester, I'm teaching that class, and there have been some really big changes to the search engine algorithms for Google, which is by far the most popular search engine, in an attempt to deal with the problems that are caused by websites using a lot of very similar AI-generated content. When you have so much similar content, it's hard for the search engine to tell what information is good or what the original source is. The point is, these algorithms do change, and you, as the user of search, do not really know when it happens or what it means when it does. And this can be an issue for you. So ultimately, humans have a big role in the quality of search results. Even if you did have an algorithm that gave you the best information, if it had access to every piece of information in the world on your topic, it was all digital, and it didn't use a financial incentive to give you what you want, you probably still are not going to make very good use of that information. Those cognitive biases that you have will, every time you look at a search page, cause you to value some information more than others. So research from Aladdin suggests that the problems with search can lead to echo chambers. They can lead to information not being the same quality for everybody, and ultimately it can perpetuate what we call a digital divide, where some people have good access to information and they get smarter, and they continue to get better access to information, and other people just don't. They don't have good access, they don't get smart as faster, and it separates. And we know that having better information can lead to better decisions. Even when you have great information, though, your decisions can sometimes still be regrettable. So let's look at a case of that. In 1992, the U.S. Olympic basketball team started a run of dominance that lasted until 2000, winning 3 Olympic gold medals and featuring the legendary Dream Team led by Michael Jordan. However, in 2004, another talented group of young players was sent to Athens, Greece with the expectation that they'd win another gold medal. The team included rising stars like Dwayne Wade, Carmelo Anthony, and LeBron James, as well as established players like Allen Iverson and Tim Duncan, and they were coached by Larry Brown, who had just won an NBA championship with the Detroit Pistons. This team should have been awesome, right? Another dominant appearance from America's best, it would really basketball's best, but things just didn't go as planned. On August 15th of that year, Puerto Rico turned Olympic hoops upside down. They blew out the U.S. team 92-73 at the very start of that tournament in Greece. That trouncing was the first in an Olympic competition for an American team with NBA players, and only the third loss at all in USA men's basketball team Olympic history. So what happened? It was a great team. They had a great coach. But despite the team's talent and athleticism, they really struggled to come together under Brown's strict coaching style, and many players disagreed with him. After that loss to Puerto Rico, they lost again to Lithuania later in the tournament. And although they did make it to the semifinals, they couldn't beat Argentina and they had to settle for the bronze medal. They defeated Lithuania in a rematch in the third-place game. And it was the team's lack of chemistry and the conflict between star player Stephon Marbury and Coach Brown that really contributed to their disappointing finish. And it's a good example of the fallacy of composition. This happens when you assume that what's true for part of something must also be true for the whole. So blueberries are good for you, right? They're a superfood. You may know that they're full of antioxidants and they're just great for your health. And you could assume that if you made up your entire diet out of blueberries, it would be the world's greatest diet. Now that's a silly example, but sometimes people will use that same logic to categorize groups of people. You know, just because you made your basketball team up out of great players and coaches doesn't mean the team as a whole is going to do well. You could get some of the best singers ever. Maybe you get Whitney Houston and Pavarotti and Tom Petty, and you make a whole choir full of these voices. It might not actually sound that good. They're wonderful soloists, but singing in a group requires being able to blend, and that may not be a skill that great solo singers develop. Newsmakers also do this sometimes, and we're going to look at an example for this week's warm-up.
Do you remember when the right wing freaked out about Bud Light? I mean, they really freaked out about Bud Light. They were shooting Bud Light cans. The right was very, very, very upset about Bud Light. They were so mad. In Florida, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis got so excited about it, he ordered an official Florida state investigation into Bud Light. In Congress, House Republicans started their own federal congressional investigation of Bud Light. They have spent the better part of the past year on this. No longer would everyone in the country see Bud Light as the beer that is slightly more flavorful than Coors Light, but not quite as flavorful as Miller Light. But the Bud Light blue is kind of a pretty color, and sometimes it's on sale, so sometimes you buy it even if you're not in love with it, because no one's really in love with it. And hey, if you're drinking light beer, no one expects to be in love with that stuff anyway. I mean, that's how we all used to think of Bud Light, admit it. But after nearly a year of right-wing culture war, no-holds-barred demagoguery against Bud Light, no longer would any self-respecting right-winger, would any self-respecting Republican buy Bud Light because it was on the end cap and came with a free koozie.
That's MSNBC's Rachel Maddow on a recent episode of her show talking about Republicans. This is a podcast, so obviously we don't have video. But this ran with clips of people shooting at cases of beer and doing things like that. And the implication is that the few people who took to social media to dramatically display how angry they were at Bud Light were in fact somehow emblematic of all Republicans. As you're listening to this, I imagine you're thinking that it's clear that she's using some sarcasm or irony here. You can tell that from her tone, and I think that's a fair conclusion. But consider this. If her words are stripped of that tone, maybe you see it in a text-based social media post, maybe you see it in a transcript, it's a little bit less clear. So that's a fallacy of composition. When we come back, we're going to hear a little bit more about search from someone who actually does search engine optimization for a living. Matt Diamante from Hey Tony Agency in Ontario, Canada, joins me for an uninterrupted interview after the break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. My guest this week is Matt Diamante. Matt is the head of digital strategy at Hey Tony, a digital marketing agency in Ontario, Canada. In addition to the work that he does for the agency, he also educates small business owners all over the world through his extremely successful TikTok and Instagram channels and his popular YouTube. And I'm really excited to talk to him this week on Unspun.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. This is awesome.
So can you tell me basically like what happens when someone types in a search query?
Yeah, so basically Google has an index of, you know, a lot of pages that exist, on the internet from different websites. And you could think of this index basically like a library. So every time somebody makes a search, Google looks through all of these pages. Obviously, they have a system, they have an algorithm that does this. But basically, if you're searching for, you want a painter in your local area who does, garage floor painting, for example, they search through their database and they're like, okay, here's the pages that we think are the most relevant for that query. And yeah, that's basically what happens.
Okay, so I got a couple of follow-up questions then. So you did mention Google first. Is that true for like any kind of search that you would do?
Most search engines are using similar algorithms, although Google has the best algorithm. They definitely have a monopoly on the search market. I believe it's like 95% of searches are happening through Google, which is absolutely incredible. It's insane.
Yeah. So when you say they have the best algorithm, what does best mean?
that I guess it's relative, but basically Google's mission is to get users the most relevant information as fast as possible. So if you go to Yahoo, for example, on their homepage where their search bar is, there's so much crap there. You see articles, you see all these different links that you can click. If you go to Google, you just see the search bar basically. And that's done by design because they want people to be able to find the information that they're looking for as quickly as possible. And then obviously they make money because they have ads that appear at the top of those search results. But yeah, that's basically it.
Okay. So I know that, for your job, you're basically helping organizations to do better in that search process, right? So if I search for, garage floor paint or whatever, right, you're helping my garage floor paint business be the one that shows up first in that. So what kind of things do they have to do better in search?
Oh my God. Okay. So if you don't know anything about search engine optimization, it's basically showing up higher on Google. So what you need to do is first you need a website. If you don't have a website, you're not going to be able to show up on Google because they have nothing to reference. You're not going to be in their index. The next thing you need is content. So you need to tell Google and users and people what your website is, what your service is, what your products are, and you do that with content. So if you ever go to a website, let's say for a dentist, and the homepage is like crazy long, it has like 1,000 words or a couple thousand words, and you're like, why would a dentist need this much information on the homepage? You really don't, because people aren't necessarily reading all of that information. A lot of that information is for search engines. Having said that, if a person does read that information, it does need to be useful. It does need to be helpful. So you can't just go in there and, you know, write a bunch of BS and just stuff your keyword in there a bunch of times. So the number one thing that you need if you want to rank on Google, if you want to show up higher on Google, is content on your website. And we do this for our clients a lot with blog posts. And I get a lot of comments and a lot of people asking, like, are blog posts still relevant? It's 2024. Like, does anybody even read a blog? And you need to stop thinking of a blog as, you know, what it used to be, where you're just talking about your day, talking about your life. Like, blogs are now resources for people. So on my site, for example, like, you can find almost all the information you would ever need to know about search engine optimization, or how to set up Facebook ads using Facebook's ad manager, or Meta ad manager now, and like how to add users, how to remove users, all that kind of stuff. So when it comes to content on your website, having a blog is very, very, very important. This does a couple things. One, it allows you to help users. You can answer questions that they have in a form of a blog post, and that helps you gain trust with that person, whether they're potential customer. I actually just recently read a book called They Ask, You Answer. And it's this guy who, I'm not sure if you've read that book or if you've even heard of it, but basically it's this guy who runs this pool company in like Virginia or something, Richmond, Virginia. And he one day just decided, I'm going to answer every question that our salespeople get. And like, he was a salesperson as well. So he just started answering all the questions, and he did that in the form of blog posts. So how much does a pool cost? What's the difference between fiberglass and cement pools? All that kind of stuff. So really what he did and what we do for our clients is we answer every possible question somebody could have about their product or service and like adjacent topics, because they may be interested in that as well. Like, we have a client who does, who sells saunas and cold tubs, you know, those little bathtubs that you put ice in and it's freezing cold and it's supposed to be good for you, but I'm never going to do it because that's like, to me, that's insane. But we basically, like, we've written almost every single answer to every single question that somebody could have about those products. So like, can you bring an iPhone in a sauna? Can you bring an Apple Watch in a sauna? How cold should a cold tub be? So we're answering all of these questions. So when somebody's on their buyer journey, they can come to us, we're the resource. And then it's also like, hey, we sell this product as well. Like, we're not being blatant and just being like, buy, 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 buy. But, you know, they're on a website that has that in their name. You know, it has that in the menu, it has that on the sidebar, all that kind of stuff. But we're really trying to educate people. And that's what you should be doing if you want to show up higher on Google's, educate people.
And so there's some specific things about like how you put the site together too, isn't there?
Yeah. So that's more technical SEO. And when I say technical SEO, you don't need to be scared. It's not actually that complicated. Basically, when you go to a website, usually the biggest text on that page is the heading one tag. The heading one tag, and you can set that usually in the back end of that page. It'll say H1 or heading one. That tag tells users what that page is. And it also tells Google what that page is about, right? What's the main topic of that page? So if you go to a page, you know, and the biggest text on the page is like painters in North Carolina. And you obviously want to be a little bit more specific than that, because you're not going to do the entire state. You're going to want to do like your town and like adjacent towns. But anyways, we'll just use the state for this instance. You get to a page that says basement painters in North Carolina. And that entire page is about that topic. But the biggest text there is your heading one tag, and that's painters, basement painters in North Carolina, or whatever the keyword is you're trying to rank for. And then you're often going to see, you know, other subheading text. So it's like, it's slightly smaller than that big text, but it answers questions and it covers subtopics of that main topic. Those are heading 2 tags or H2 tags. And basically, those just provide more information. They're basically backing up the claim or whatever it is that you're making with your heading 1 tag. So that's like, that's a little glimpse into the technical SEO. It's again, not that complicated. You literally just click a button and then say, I want this to be my heading 1 tag. I want this to be a heading 2 tag, and so on.
Okay. So it sounds like, you know, if I kind of had to summarize, there's quite a bit of strategy that needs to go on behind the scenes in order to get your page to be the one that the search engine's going to give back when someone puts in, you know, a question or a keyword that they're looking for.
Yeah, like there is some strategy, but the biggest thing is like being helpful. And Google's, I'm not sure if it's their most recent update at this point, but they released like a big one last year in 2023 that was like, this is the helpful content update. You need to make sure the content on your website is helpful. Doesn't matter if it's written by a person, if it's written by AI, like ChatGPT or something. If it's good and it's helpful and people are finding the answers to their questions, then like in Google's mind, like you should be ranking higher. It's not always the case. There's a lot of factors that go into it, but if you can be helpful, that will certainly give you a boost.
So you brought up something I think that's pretty important there. And so in my day job as a college professor, I do teach classes in SEO, like to our graduate students. And one of the things that's always challenging is the fact that the algorithm changes, right? So the process, the set of rules that Google uses to determine what's a good search and what they're going to return. And like, you have no control over when that changes. And I have no control over when that changes. And sometimes it changes in the middle of a semester and, you know, those kind of things. So definitely keeps the job fun to try to.
Absolutely. But one of the things that we've seen with our clients, because like I've been doing SEO for almost like 10 or more than 10 years, more than a decade at this point. And one of the things that I never see is when Google does an update, our sites don't go down, because we're not doing anything that's like, everything that we're doing is above board. That's what Google wants. And at the core, we are being helpful. So anybody who's coming to the website is getting some kind of value from the content that we're creating for either ourselves or our clients. And if you do that, like, you shouldn't be hit with like a Google algorithm update and then all of a sudden you're like I need to revisit a bunch of stuff.
Yeah. Okay. And so you mentioned that everything you do is like good strategies. Are people still doing bad strategy kind of things?
Oh my God, yes. So we have a client, I won't say who it is, but all of their URLs, so the links to pages on their website, were stuffed with so many keywords. And like that worked like, you know, maybe 10 years ago, like doing that. And even at that point, like it's still like spammy, scammy kind of looking links. They had so many of those on their website. They lost almost all of their traffic. I actually think their traffic bottomed out at 0 by the time we started working together. And so people still are doing that. People still are buying bad backlinks, which if you don't know what a backlink is, basically it's a link from another website to your site. So a lot of these spammers and scammers will buy backlinks from what they call like link farms or private blog networks or anything like that, where basically you know, you could pay $500, you could pay $50, get a bunch of links to your website. And let me take a step back. Backlinks are one of the core parts of Google's algorithm. So if you don't have backlinks, if you don't have other sites basically voting for your site saying, hey, you know, this is great content or these guys are trustworthy, then Google's not necessarily going to show you in their search results. So there's a lot to SEO that you need to do. But anyways, back to the main point. Yes, people still are doing like the spammy, scammy stuff. And like oftentimes we have to come in and fix it. And, you know, the client or the lead or the potential client is like, well, why are you charging so much? And I'm like, we have to fix everything that that person did if we can, because I don't know if you necessarily have, you know, a derogatory mark in, you know, in Google or something, or if they've like shadow banned you or something like that. So we have to do a lot of work to reverse all the bad stuff that was done.
I guess one of the ways I kind of talk about it with my students is you almost have like two audiences, right? So you have like your human audience, who are the ones who are actually going to be using your site, trying to, you know, gather the useful information from it. And then you have like your robot audience,
Right. That has its set of rules that are intended to mimic what the human audience wants. And it's getting better at that all the time, but it's not always like exactly the same. So you mentioned AI at one point. From your perspective on the ground, how is AI impacting how you're working right now?
We use AI every single day in so many different ways. The biggest way that we use AI is like basically ChatGPT to write the content for us. So we obviously, we do all the keyword research. We make sure that we're writing topics that people are actually searching for, and we're, you know, writing helpful we're answering their questions in a helpful way. So basically ChatGPT is taking out all the, you know, the blank page paralysis that you get. It's like, okay, where do I start with this? ChatGPT will basically write us the first version of a piece of content, and then we'll go in and edit it, make sure it's like fact check it and do all that kind of stuff, and then do all like the technical SEO, make sure it has heading tags, make sure it has internal links, external links, all that kind of stuff. But most importantly, we make sure that it's helpful. So ChatGPT, you know, takes it from maybe 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours to write one piece of content down to 2 or 3.
And so do you think that because it does make it easier and faster that, you know, you described a process where you're very worried about quality, right? So that like you have like that first draft and you're going to go in and check it and make sure it's helpful and make sure it's factual and all of those kinds of things. Do you think it's also going to, in some ways, maybe water down the quality of information that's available online just because it is easier?
Absolutely. But at the end of the day, quality content is going to win. Anybody can go into ChatGPT and say, write me an article about whatever topic they want, and it'll spit out something really great, you know, something very comprehensive. But is it necessarily answering the questions? Is it optimized properly? Could you be adding other things in there? And some of the times that we see with ChatGPT or, you know, any of these AI writers, some of the information is just not factually correct. So you need to have a human go in there and double check things and edit things and make sure that you're, you know, injecting that human element to it.
Perfect. Matt, I really appreciate all of your time.
Absolutely.
Thanks for getting Unspun with me this week. Unspun is a production of me, Amanda Sturgill, and is a proud member of the MSW Media family of podcasts. Send me your thoughts and ideas about trickery in the news on Gmail at theunspunpodcast@gmail.com. I even write back. And find this episode's show notes and more information at theunspunpodcast.substack.com. Want to learn more and get smarter? Check out my book, Detecting Deception, Tools to Fight Fake News, which is available on Amazon or your favorite online bookseller. And until next time, stay sharp, everyone.